Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you very much. I just want to add my thanks to the organisers for giving me the opportunity to come. I think someone pointed out to me yesterday I'd probably spent longer in the air than I had actually on the ground in The Hague, which is a slightly depressing thought. So bearing in mind that Chantal's covered some of the material, there's a bit of overlap between the papers, and the fact that jet lag is kicking in, I will try to keep this as short as possible. So Chantal's already pitched on this, but if we go back to the Rome Statute negotiations, it's often used as the example of the highlight of, or the high point of civil society involvement in terms of negotiating the statute and the involvement in its drafting. During those negotiations, civil society also pushed very hard for increased rights of participation in the processes of the court. Now, one source of participation that was quite a controversial mechanism was the idea of having the independent prosecutor. We've spoken a lot already about the proprio motu power. And linked to that was the ability of civil society actors to put in Article 15 communications under the statute. And that's a novel and an important avenue for civil society to interact with the court. I also want to highlight that there are other avenues for participation under the statute, one of which is the amicus curiae, which is not really a novel item. It's been included in the statutes of many other, or the rules, procedure and evidence of many other tribunals. And there's also some broader rights of participation in the reparations phase. So my interest in this topic comes at it from quite a different perspective, in that I've just finishing, or should be finishing, a 3 to 4 year project on the role of the amicus curiae in international criminal justice. I find myself slightly stunned that at the end of 3 or 4 years I still have something new I can say about that topic, but it's one that seems to have quite a lot of academic and practical interest. So what I've been looking at is concentrating more on the civil society actor and why they might choose to participate in proceedings, and in some ways contrasting the role that you see under Article 15 with that of the amicus curiae, see if there are any lessons or improvements that could be made to the preliminary examination phase. So I do come to it really not so much the preliminary examination focus, but really seeing what we can draw from the other ways in which civil society participate. So as we progress in our research, what became clear is that for many civil society actors, there's not a clean divide between Article 15 or for amicus curiae. It's often one of their just a way of influencing the court, a way of a broader strategy, which Andreas pointed out, of trying to influence proceedings in international criminal justice. It also became clear with many of the amicus submissions that what they were actually trying to do was not so much influence a chamber, but really try and push the prosecutor or try and influence the prosecutor to take certain actions. So that's why it seemed a good gap to address in the context of preliminary examinations. So briefly, what I want to do in the time I have left is to outline again briefly why civil society, the kind of normative framework, the justifications for allowing civil society to participate. Compare briefly, again, the two mechanisms and the practice we're seeing in both. Come back to a point that Chantal raised, which is this idea of the lack of standing to review decisions of the prosecutor in the preliminary examination phase. And then finally, to perhaps to make some what I hope are quite practical recommendations as to what we could learn from this paper. So first, why is civil society participation a worthy development? If you go back through the quite copious literature on amicus curiae and civil society involvement, particularly from the US, there seem to be three justifications. So the first one, it allows a broader representation of interests and participants and different perspectives. The second one, and this is more relevant to our purposes, it improves the quality of decision making by placing additional and perhaps different information before the decision maker. And thirdly, it enhances the transparency and the accountability of those decisions that are being taken. And the argument is that this then adds to the legitimacy of both those decisions, but also the institution itself. Now, those points are developed around the amicus, but I think they apply equally, although slightly differently, to the role of civil society around Article 15 communications. So I think, as was discussed yesterday, civil society certainly can form external scrutiny, external quality control. Now, the second point is that the amicus and Article 15 are very different mechanisms. I won't go through a detailed comparison, I'm just going to make a few points. So the first one is the amicus is a very tightly controlled and discretionary mechanism, and the chambers do assert very strict control over this. They only accept a submission where it's helpful, where it's going to help them make a proper determination of the case. Whereas the OTP has no discretion at all, really, in whether or not they are accepting the communication. There's evidence there's a vast number of communications that are received, And then you compare that to the very small number of amicus curiae submissions that are actually accepted. It's a vastly different enterprise. Second point, as was highlighted yesterday, the volume content, particularly whether it's legal or factual, and the quality of Article 15 communications varies significantly. In contrast, most amicus submissions tend to be tightly focused. They're often set specific questions they have to address. They have very strict page limits, and they're much more limited in their scope. They also tend to be prepared by lawyers or actors who've had experience as an amicus, either in the International Criminal Court or other fora. There's no similar limits for Article 15 if you look at the length and the differences in quality and quantity and content. And if you look particularly at the number of those communications that are dismissed as being manifestly outside the jurisdiction, it perhaps suggests that the quality and the understanding is not as good as it could be. It's certainly clear that not every communication is particularly helpful to the prosecutor, and that's a clear difference of the amicus. There is some anecdotal evidence that those seeking Article 15 communications are actually lawyering up and they are becoming a bit more helpful in terms of the content and the focus. So hopefully that means their quality and their usefulness would improve. Another point I want to make is that there is more evidence of strategic communications that we see at the Article 15 stage. So these are defined as communications that are put before the OTP without any real prospect that any ICC action will follow. We've kind of hinted at these today and yesterday. So there may be other reasons why civil society actors are putting in an Article 15 communication, whether it's responding to domestic politics, trying to trigger a domestic process, or just a broader strategy of engagement around a particular issue. It's clear also that Article 15 is linked much more closely to the domestic politics of a situation. In contrast, amicus submissions tend to have a much more long-term legal or political goal in mind. They're not so much linked to a particular situation. And what we see is more repeat players who are putting in these consistent submissions in a range of proceedings, whereas Article 15, they tend to focus on a particular situation and be quite discreetly linked there. We don't tend to see repeat players, at least that I know of, in Article 15. I was going to talk about publicity, but I won't, because that's been dealt with briefly this morning. I just want to also make a final point of comparison, which goes to quality, is that amici are caught by the Code of Professional Conduct at the ICC. Many of them don't realise it, but they are, which means there are consequences if you're putting poor, misleading, or any kind of inappropriate conduct. In contrast, there's not really been any similar consideration as the ethical or professional obligations of those who put evidence before the court in an Article 15 communication. I'll use that to get to my conclusions at the end. I just want to talk briefly about, and Chantelle's covered some of it, about the issue of lack of standing. And this seems to be the real point of frustration for civil society actors. They can put a communication forward, but they don't have the right to seek a review of that. That was contained in the Rome Statute, and I think the emphasis there was about containing a kind of ambitious or overly political prosecutor. It wasn't really about pushing a reluctant prosecutor to move forward, and I think that's where the tension is. Now, there's been some suggestion that the amicus could kind of help push that role along, but unfortunately it's a fairly limited tool to try and address that. It's a friend of the court, it's not a friend of the prosecutor. So the idea is that the amicus is only available once the judicial proceedings are triggered. So that means it's quite limited. You're really looking at an Article 15 decision, and there have been attempts to submit an amicus there or in those proceedings that are already able to be reviewed, and we saw a couple of attempts in the Comoros decisions. Other than that, there's no standing, and that's the real issue for civil society. The court's been very clear it isn't going to extend the rights of standing beyond those contained in the Rome Statute. So the idea that there'll be broader rights given to civil society without some kind of amendment to the Rome Statute is a difficult one. And also, I'm arguing there should be broader rights. I think there's a real balance that would need to be made. Every single person or actor that submitted something to the prosecutor could challenge and have judicial review proceedings. There would be a significant burden on the prosecutor. And then we also have the issue of how we deal with strategic communications that aren't really there trying to produce any action in the first place. So finally, in terms of recommendations, I thought the suggestion yesterday by the Vice President of the ICTY about having greater judicial control over the preliminary examination phase is an interesting one. It would also have the incidental effect of allowing a right of participation as an amicus, or at least the ability to apply to be an amicus. And that would be available to not just those who submitted a communication, but to other actors, including to states and other actors that might want to participate. Second point is there are risks with expanding rights of participation to civil society actors during the preliminary examination phase, and it's important that we realise those risks and incorporate them into any steps. Third, there's no need for a friend of the prosecutor. We already have a mechanism to put information before the prosecutor, that's Article 15, and the court has stressed that. What is really a problem is the quality and the quantity of the information that's already there. The problem isn't an absence of information, it's how to deal with the information that is there. Another point is that we need to focus on improving the quality of what goes before the OTP, and I would echo the calls yesterday for having greater guidance from the OTP as to what use they make of their information and how it will be used, so that that will then serve as a guide to civil society actors trying to prepare these types of communications. I think it may well be that this is happening anyway, but it's very hard to see from the outside. There is also this frustration among civil society actors about the lack of input into key decisions. What could perhaps allay this frustration and might enhance quality of decision making might be to have more targeted calls for submissions at certain key points of the preliminary examination phase. So say, for example, the OTP is aware that a particular legal issue is going to be crucial in its decision. They could call for specific, maybe page limited, whatever, focus submissions in the same way a chamber would call for an amicus submission on those particular points. And that would allow civil society and other actors to feel they've at least had the opportunity to put something before the OTP. And there's a precedent for this. If we look at how the issue of Palestine the first time round was dealt with, there was quite a broad consultation and call for submissions around the issue of statehood. Finally, there does need to be some thought given to how to control or to manage strategic communications. That said, it needs to be balanced against the fact this is an important avenue of access, and we don't want to unduly restrict the role of civil society in their access to the court. And I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.